This is Cinephile.
This is incredible. Moonlight won Best Picture.
One of the best actors alive here with us in the studio, Billy Bob Thornton. Great to see you, man.
The point of good acting is that you're supposed to be real.
Great to have here on Cinephile Ice Cube, my new best friend.
Yay, man.
Here's the man himself, Robert De Niro.
Who can tell what a reaction will be to a film? That nobody knows.
Viggo Mortensen.
It's one of those movies that when it finishes, you go, now what's going to happen?
Big guest, Mark Wahlberg.
Ted was one of those pivotal moments in my career, like Boogie Nights, where, you know, the subject matter just seems so ridiculous and absurd. Yet, when reading the script, you know, you never want to put it down.
Cinephile. The Adnan Virk Movie Podcast.
Oh, man. I just got finished saying how you have to be on point vocally as Jim Brockmeyer, and I completely punted that one.
We end up with an intoxicating, brain-melting yarn that for all its pleasures has ideas a little above its station. It's not Kafka. Then again, it doesn't need to be. That's Donald Clark of the Irish Times. We'll be reviewing Blade Runner 2049. As well as Battle of the Sexes. Here's one other quote I got to read to you. Christopher Orr from The Atlantic. From the grayed out countrysides over which the sky has closed like a lid, to the drizzly neon decadence of Los Angeles, to the Ozymandian wreckage of Las Vegas, the film is a visual splendor of the First Order. So Blade Runner 2049 we'll talk about, along with Battle of the Sexes, and Earth, One Amazing Day, which is a G-rated movie. Don't get enough of those these days. All about nature and the wonderful world we live in. Narrated by Robert Redford. Speaking of Robert Redford, Gina had tweeted us at Cinephile saying she wants an actor's showcase in The Golden Boy. So you got it, Gina. We'll break down Redford's best movies of his career. Plus, my guy Martin Scorsese penning an article in The Hollywood Reporter in which he praises Mother, criticizes Rotten Tomatoes and CinemaScore. I'll tell you how my boy, my idol, my guy, where he's dead wrong, and where I somewhat agree with him. Our special guest this time on Cinephile, Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter. Scott has a terrific podcast I encourage all of you to listen to. His writing is excellent in The Hollywood Reporter, which I subscribe to, thanks to Kathy Leogrand, who hooked me up with a subscription after my visit to Le Moyne. And Scott's going to tell us all about this Harvey Weinstein saga, which has just engulfed the world of film, and it just keeps getting worse and worse, which is horrifying to think about. We'll also touch on the Oscar race and maybe some stories from what it's like for Scott in his journeys as someone covering entertainment. Speaking of somebody who covers entertainment, Ben Lyons and I spoke. He's well aware of this running bit now on Cinephile that he has not given his top 10 movies of the century. He told me to tell Dan he's got six of the movies so far, but he's now reluctant to divulge. He wants to see how long we can just string this thing out.
Tell him I need the list before the Knicks win their first game.
He is recovering about the Melo news, but he said it took him hard. He tweeted immediately after Melo was traded, just don't at me, don't call me, don't text me. I need to take a long walk. So he's recovering. But he and Dan, of course, big Carmelo Anthony fans. Speaking of being fans, you heard in that open there, the last drop there of Brockmeyer. How about this? If only I could multiply myself. I got a text from my agent last Friday. What are you doing next Wednesday? Today, by the way, we're taping it on a Wednesday. And I said, you know, usual little... A little column A, a little column B, a little baseball tonight, a little podcast. He's like, all right, got a potential job for you. I'll check back. I'm like, all right, may not work. And I was like, well, you want to just tell me what it is? He's like, Brockmeyer, season two filming in Atlanta. I'm like, oh, man, come on. He's like, all right, let me see what I can do, blah, blah, blah. So I don't know what the latest is. I think that they needed me for a couple of days. I asked Kurtz when he did his cameo season one. He goes, yeah, I flew down in the morning. I was there overnight. So maybe they were like, listen, because I was like, I can fly down first flight in the morning. I can be back by like 8 p.m., do the show at night, but they're like, eh. So it's in flux right now. But this is what's holding me back as an actor, is the fact I got this ESPN job holding me back.
Why don't you just take the day off?
Just tell my Baseball Tonight people, hey, I know it's the playoffs. Strasburg's
the 15th. Tell Iger. Go higher. Go up the chain. He emails me like four times a year, this Iger guy. Shoot him a note. Say, hey, Bobby Iges.
Yeah.
I got a TV show I got to shoot.
I'm ready for my close-up.
Yeah. Okay? Yeah. There you go.
I asked my agent, I said, what would the role be? I'm assuming I'm playing myself, because I'd like to play, I mean, a baseball player. I'd like to play the second baseman straight from Morocco. I hit a home run. Brockmeyer says, welcome to Tangier. I mean, how tremendous would that be? Because, no, I think you'd be playing yourself. So let's hope, fingers crossed. Hank, if you're listening, let's make it happen, man. I just want to be on set. I want to be in Brockmeyer. Hopefully that'll happen. Thanks to all those who listened to the podcast last time out.
I honestly thought it was one of our best ones, which is why I was confounded as to why it was not on the Apple podcast right away. I got a lot of tweets about that, people asking. It's there now. Maybe Dan can explain why it was not showing up for people immediately.
So it didn't show up for the first week. We have an exclusive rights deal with the TuneIn app. So when, as soon as I post the podcast, it goes right to TuneIn exclusively for a week. I don't know what sum of money they are paying our company. We are seeing 0 cents of it, for the record. And 1 week later, it then starts showing up on Apple Podcasts and in the ESPN app. You can still access it that way.
Yeah.
It won't show up in your feed.
Okay, that's good to know, because a lot of people were tweeting me about that. So exactly what Dan just said. When I tweet it, you click on the link, it's there. Or use this wonderful TuneIn app. You can find it out there. But as far as showing up, Richard Lewis showed up a week after we had taped it. But if you haven't listened to it, he was hysterical. Curb Your Enthusiasm off to a blistering start so far. Dan, have you watched the first two episodes?
I have. I'm all caught up.
How about, my favorite episode, spoiler alert, was Palestinian Chicken. I just love the fact they've now brought it back. We have another horrifying...
A recurring character, if you will.
I don't know any Muslims. They don't work in show business. I don't run into them at the deli. Maybe I could go to a mosque, talk to them there. I don't want to spoil it. Just go watch Curb Your Enthusiasm. The scene with Richard Lewis, by the way, the first time him and Larry. Come over here. No, you come over here. No, you come over here. That whole bit back and forth, incredible. I don't live in a Cuban dance hall. Curb Your Enthusiasm is the best. Make sure you listen to Richard Lewis. As always, you can look up Cinephile on iTunes and the ESPN app. But, of course, on iTunes, please give us a rating. I rank my movies at a 4 Maple Leafs. The rating there at a 5 stars. Leave us a review. Let us know what you like, what you don't like, and we'll go from there. We appreciate it. Before we get to a review of Blade Runner 2049, the sequel long in the making, we like to give back here, so why not? We got some shirts. It's a fall movie extravaganza. Dan's dialed up another quiz. Your chance to win Cinephile T-shirts, as long as you answer these questions correct and tweet us at Cinephile ESPN, C-I-N-E-P-H-I-L-E ESPN. Dan, what do we got?
How many shirts do you think? Like 5, 7? Seven. First 7 correct answers to these 6 questions. There is a bonus question involved. First 7. Okay, so I've recently been watching a lot of Jeopardy. There's a great contestant going in, 11-time champion. Austin Rogers is his name. So there's kind of I wrote them as if they were Jeopardy clues, some of them, so to speak.
Love it. I could see you being a big Jeopardy guy.
And huge, yeah.
And I saw you tweeting about him saying, hey, get on this, you got to watch this guy.
Question 1. It's handled. The wife of this recent guest wears the white hat on network television. Do you know the answer?
Say it one more time.
It's handled. The wife of this recent guest wears the white hat on network television.
I don't know the answer to this, actually.
Okay, well, you did not mention the wife in your interview with this person.
Okay.
That should have narrowed it down for you.
Oh, I got you. Okay, good.
Okay, because I told you the next day I didn't even know it. But,
I got you.
Question 2. The only actor spotlight in which a non-movie role made the top 5 was for this actor, who hasn't exactly been rising since winning an Oscar.
I like that. Good wordplay there. I like this Jeopardy theme here.
Okay.
Rising. I got it.
This one's just kind of straightforward. Question 3. Adnan recently described Leonardo DiCaprio's Chaplin-esque performance in a scene in this movie.
Very good. My brother sent me the GIF.
Ooh.
From that movie, so that'll help. Yep.
Question 4. In an effort to disprove the, quote, Bob Costas of Canada, Adnan went on the record and said that this project is the worst that Martin Scorsese has ever done. Bonus points if you can name the SportsCenter anchor who disagreed.
Oh, yeah, that's very good. Yes.
That's your bonus question.
Yeah, I like the bonus question.
If you can sneak that in, great. You don't have to.
Sure.
Question 5. Although my movie knowledge is microscopic compared to Adnan's, we almost had to go to the nuclear option, me hosting, because Adnan was suffering from a severe case of strep throat. Which film did I plan on reviewing and then eventually review in a subsequent episode?
Very good. Excellent.
And finally, the recently deceased actor Frank Vincent, who was in Raging Bull, Goodfellas, and Casino, got his start in acting thanks to his friendship with Joe Pesci. In fact, they were in a band together. What was the name of the band?
That should be the bonus question. Like, if you get that right, you get 10 t-shirts, buddy.
You did mention it in the podcast.
Right. Somebody can probably do a Google search, but you're right. Hopefully people heard of the podcast. That's an excellent quiz. Once again, Cinephile ESPN, C-I-N-E-P-H-I-L-E ESPN. I mentioned LeMoyne briefly there. Hopefully we're going to make a return visit. Kathy Leogrand working feverishly to get me up there in November. Once again, Dino Barbecue with the Stanzics. This time I get to meet his brother Mike, maybe his wife as well. Let's see if we can make this thing happen. But thanks to Julia Grossman, Phil Novak, of course, they're part of the film department at LeMoyne. And so hopefully I get to see them soon. I appreciate the fact they're listening to this. So maybe we'll do another road trip here for Cinephile. And I will bring some shirts as well, of course, up to New York State. Blade Runner 2049, a long sequel in the making. I'll give my review first, and then I'll talk about what everyone seems to be talking about, which is why the box office was disappointing. First and foremost, do you need to see the original Blade Runner? No, you don't. Have I seen it? Yes. What do I think of it? I think it's all right. I think it's one of those movies that does not hold the test of time. I think it was really important for its time. 1982, Ridley Scott, what he was doing, it was different, very cerebral science fiction story. But I don't think if, Dan pops it up in his DVD player, he's going to be blown away by it. But if you want to check it out, go ahead, check it out. I do not think it's a prerequisite for seeing Denis Villeneuve's sequel. In fact, the first page is a little bit of a scrawl explaining what a Blade Runner is, and away we go. So the basic of it is that now the story has, gone forward 30 years. We're now in 2049. Ryan Gosling, you'll find out his backstory, but he's now on a mission, and eventually he's trying to find Deckard. Of course, Deckard was the famous character played by Harrison Ford, who's back again. And I while watching this film, I thought about what my dear friends, Randall Thorne, shout out to Randall, who is listening, by the way. He's an accomplished director. He's actually in Paris doing his show, which is unbelievable. I'm so proud of him. But RT and I were talking about Eyes Wide Shut, and my friend Mike Kiss as well. Mike's also a huge star, by the way. Terrific writer. He's very, very fun. One of the funniest people I know. We were talking about Eyes Wide Shut, and we said it's not that the movie's so long. You know, when someone watches a long movie, you could have cut out 20 minutes. But it's just if you shortened all the scenes by 10 seconds, then that would actually be the right way to watch it. So Eyes Wide Shut is a long movie, but it's not like that scene's extraneous or that superfluous. You just go, everything just feels long because Kubrick tends such a long takes and everything's just drawn out. So similarly, I had that feeling watching Blade Runner 2049. It's 2 hours and 45 minutes. Like, it's a long movie, and I think it's too long. But I don't necessarily feel like that subplot wasn't necessary or the deliberate style that Villeneuve is going for is wrong. I think I completely understand what he's doing. He wants it to be entrancing and spellbinding and haunting, and a movie with quicker cuts and faster editing wouldn't have worked. So I totally appreciate he's putting you in this mood, in this zone, which is so atmospheric. But I think he could have shortened the scenes by 10 seconds and just kind of kept the pace up a little bit. Now, having said that, I appreciate the fact he was saying, listen, I'm not going to go to what maybe modern day audiences are used to in terms of a science fiction movie. There's not a ton of action in this movie. And the first hour, you're watching it unfold and you're understanding the backstory, and it's very melodic. They said, okay, when are we going to get some chase sequences? Like, when are the bad guys going to come out? We'll get some tasers, like, whatever, let's go. And you never really get that. So I thought it was really, it's impressive that they're trying to be atypical in terms of summer blockbusters, which is surprising until you know Villeneuve's work, because he did Arrival, which my buddy Dan is a big fan of, and that was a very atypical commercial blockbuster. It had A-list stars, but it wasn't an alien movie the way you'd expect. There's no big chase sequence. There's no big payoff. It's very cerebral. So actually, when you watch Blade Runner 2049, if you didn't know Villeneuve directed it, you'd say, well, I can kind of see similarities with Arrival in terms of tone and temperament. So I don't think the story has a huge payoff. I think maybe that's deliberate. Maybe there's going to be another movie to this. Maybe there's a sequel planned. I don't think it's unsatisfying. I just think that it isn't. It confounds audience expectations, which may be why the film didn't do as well as they were hoping box office-wise. They were hoping for in the $45 to $55 million range for the opening of this movie. Now, it was still the highest opening ever for Ryan Gosling, for him as a star of the film. Highest opening ever for a Villeneuve film. He also did Prisoners. But $32.8 million was the opening box office. It's about $10 to $20 million less than what the audiences thought. And it goes back to the thought, the original Blade Runner was not Star Wars. Like, it itself was a cult sci-fi film embraced by critics. And this is another film with glowing reviews, 88% on Rotten Tomatoes. So it's not like they're making The Last Jedi and you're expecting billions. It's a movie that was itself a cult hit, which has now been revived. So for mass audiences, maybe they're not going to be that into it. And as I said, in terms of its style, it's not meant to be a crowd pleaser. So it actually shouldn't be surprising that the film didn't reach those expectations. Maybe the expectations should have been off. But there seems to be a lot of hand-wringing now going, hey, why wasn't Blade Runner better received? And listen, it still made $33 million. I do think it's going to get nominations in the technical categories. It still should be deemed a success. Speaking of those nominations, there's one star of this film that it has to be discussed in great detail. He is one of the best ever in terms of being a craftsman. oftentimes we love discussing the Oscars and saying, what's the greatest miscarriage of justice? People love saying, all right, what should have won Best Picture that didn't? Dan and I ourselves have talked about this. You know, Ordinary People over Raging Bull, Dances with Wolves over Goodfellas, Pulp Fiction losing to Forrest Gump, etc. But I often think about who's somebody that's never won that should have won. And again, we often focus on actors. Prior to Leo winning for The Revenant, how has DiCaprio never won an Oscar, etc.? The greatest miscarriage of justice ever is, of course, the fact Alfred Hitchcock never won a competitive Oscar. He's widely considered to be the greatest director of all time, certainly the most influential, yet he did not win Best Director. Instead, he won an honorary Oscar, lifetime achievement late in his career. The biggest one right now, though, for me, is Roger Deakins. Who's Roger Deakins? He is a genius. He is a cinematographer who is 68 years old, who has never won, even though he's been nominated countless times, and this film might be his best work, which is really saying something when I list off some of these movies he's done. According to GoldDerby.com, which is where I'm a part of with the other Oscar experts, we currently have in the category of cinematography, Deakins as a 27-10 favorite to win, like overwhelming favorite. That's how beautifully shot this movie is. There are scenes that literally take your breath away. You'll say, wow. And I don't know how much of this was green screen. So think about how hard this was to be as a cinematographer. Like, it's one thing, Dunkirk looks beautiful, but Nolan eschews green screen. So he has a lot of, you know, the replica modern airplanes, etc. Like, Deakins does this in a way that I don't even know how to describe. Here are some of the movies he's done. And think about the fact he hasn't won an Oscar for any of these movies. No Country for Old Men, The Shawshank Redemption, Prisoners, Fargo, which is one of the most beautiful movies I've ever seen. The way he shoots snow. The Man Who Wasn't There, which is gorgeous black and white. Barton Fink, Big Lebowski, A Beautiful Mind, Dead Man Walking, Doubt, Revolutionary Road, Homicide, The Hurricane, Courage Under Fire, a couple movies with Denzel, and Scorsese's Kundun, which is just a gorgeous-looking film, even though I think the narrative is a little empty. We'll talk about it sometime in Scorsese's stories. This guy's never won an Oscar. Like, are you kidding me? So if you like Roger Deakins' work, or if you like cinematography, if you like a beautiful film, just go see Blade Runner 24 to enjoy the work of Deakins. The other part of this, my wife and I recently saw Hamilton for our 10-year anniversary, and immediately I bought the soundtrack afterwards. I know that's not on vogue right now to buy soundtracks, but if somebody was selling the soundtrack to Blade Runner 2049 in the theater immediately after the showing, I would have pulled it up $20. And I had to Google afterwards. I said, all right, let's see who did it. Hans Zimmer. Of course, Hans Zimmer cannot lose. Dunkirk and Blade Runner 2049. The original score is very famous. Vangelis did the score for the Ridley Scott film. But this soundtrack is unbelievable. Dan used to send me emails, you know, with my SAT words. The best word to describe this soundtrack is ethereal. That is the only way to describe this film. It is just heavenly listening to this music. It is a gorgeous score. I mean, honestly, I'm going to have to go buy the CD. It's such beautiful music. So Blade Runner 2049, like I said, it's going to be challenging for some audiences. Here's another word for you. It's a little esoteric, I think, in terms of its delivery. But for the cinematography, for the score, and if you like the original and you want to know something on the acting, sure. Gosling's fine. Like, he's just cool. This is cool Ryan Gosling, all right? This is his cool look. No smiles, very handsome, rigid. You get Harrison Ford eventually, but it's really not a film you see for the acting. You see it for the story and the way it sets up. But if you love science fiction, I highly recommend Blade Runner 2049. I'm giving it 3 Maple Leafs for this latest film from Denis Villeneuve. The next film on the docket is Battle of the Sexes, and Ben Lyons nailed it. After we spoke, he said, have you seen it yet? I said, no, I'm going to see it. And he goes, you know, it's perfect for the Hidden Figures crowd. And immediately I cringed. I said, oh, well, I didn't like Hidden Figures at all. I didn't think that should have been nominated Best Picture. And Ben goes, just trust me. And it's like, I don't know why they do this. They always make sports movies for sports audiences. No, excuse me. They make sports movies for audiences that are not sports fans. But in doing so, they never really attract a broad audience. It's the strangest thing. So Battle of the Sexes, they don't want to make it for tennis hardcore fans, because obviously that would be a niche audience. So they try to make it this broad story. So rather than focusing on the tennis of Billie Jean King and Bonnie Riggs, of course we're going to get that at the end, but just 10 minutes, you know. It's really about female empowerment. The story is really about Billie Jean King coming to terms with her sexuality, her relationship with her hairdresser, coming out. She was married at the time, you know, all these challenges she's facing, you know, women's lib, et cetera. And Riggs and his issues about gambling and how that led to problems with his marriage. Welcome back, Elizabeth Shue. She plays his wife in the movie. I haven't seen her in a movie in years. She's great. So they don't, you know, it's not really a tennis movie, of course, right? It's tangentially about tennis, but really it's about female empowerment. And so just like Hidden Figures, it's not really about black women who are scientists. It's about, you know, overcoming obstacles, and I thought it was a very sanitized look at race relations. Similarly, Battle of the Sexes did not do well at the box office, because again, I'm like, well, I just don't know who the audience is playing for. So back to Ben's point, It's very surfacey. It's very glossy. You know, Emma Stone's fine. She looks, I mean, talk about doppelgangers. It's uncanny how much she looks like Billie Jean King. Once she gets the haircut and the glasses, I mean, that's unbelievable. And Carell, for that matter, when I heard he was playing Bobby Riggs, I don't know a ton about Bobby Riggs, but I'm like, yeah, Carell probably looks just like with the sideburns and the glasses. I'm like, he's also a little paunchy. The guy's 55 in the movie. So he nails it. So the movie is light. It's fluffy. I'm giving it 2 Maple Leafs. Like I said, it's really focusing on her journey, which I thought was a little much. After a while, I'm like, okay, I got it. Can we get to some actual tennis? But maybe I'm not the hardcore audience you're looking for. I recognize that. But it's well acted. The stuff with Carell and his gambling addiction is sometimes played for laughs, but I appreciate the honesty with which they showed it. The actual battle of the sexes, of course, is at the end of the movie. If you don't know the story, she was 29 years old, top-ranked women's tennis player. Bobby Riggs was 55 years old, trying to get his name back. Publicity stunt. As he said, I'm going to put the show in chauvinism. And said, I want to play Billie Jean King. Yeah, he's got a lot of great one-liners like that. I mean, that's the thing. He's the villain ostensibly, but maybe because it's Carell and he's such a likable actor, you can't help but kind of root for the guy because he's just so funny. And he's in on the joke. Like, he's not actually a male chauvinist. He's not actually a pig, but I play one on TV. And that's exactly what he's doing. And even his wife says, like, what are you doing? You're just insulting all women. No, women belong in the kitchen, not on the tennis court. All right, good. More publicity. I'm on the cover of Time. He once says to his wife, I'm on the cover of Time magazine. I never did that. I won Wimbledon. I never got that kind of fame. Great. I'm getting money for it, et cetera. Here's my major quibble, and now I rely on Dan Stancic's tennis knowledge. The last time maybe this is untrue. The last time I checked, when I heard about the story was always that Riggs threw the match. She was 29. He was 55. She beat him, but he wasn't really on the up and up. He had gambling debts, and so he was throwing the match for gambling. The movie does not make that to be the case. The movie makes it that Riggs is trying to win, is huffing and puffing and laboring, and Billie Jean King beats him. And afterwards, he's upset, and Elizabeth Shue, spoiler alert, they're estranged. And then she goes back to see him, and he has like a smile on his face because he's happy to see his wife. And that's it. I'm like, wait, I thought he should be laughing with glee. Like, ha-ha, I pulled it off. Because I thought he gambled on himself or was paying off a gambling debt to lose, which the movie completely ignores. So maybe I have ignored sports history. I asked Rosillo, and Rosillo goes, no, what you're saying sounds vaguely familiar. I do remember something about...
I think I'm with Rosillo, and I also think you keep trying to make him be the hero.
Yeah.
But just think about where you started. This movie is for who? It's for the Hidden Figures crowd. Right. So even if that was the case,
yeah,
that's some of the truth that's going to be altered a little bit. I wasn't alive. When did this match take place? I wasn't even alive yet.
Yeah.
I've just vaguely heard of the match, and I knew she won. I didn't know under which circumstances, but that does sound vaguely familiar.
Right. If someone said you didn't Riggs throw the match, you'd go, yeah, I thought
so. But if you're expecting like him to be laughing and like that's how the movie's going to end, like you're wrong. They wouldn't have made that movie. The movie was made because of the female empowerment.
Right. But
you understand where we are in 2017 right now.
But why wouldn't he at the end have said to his wife, like, I did this just to pay off my debts. Like, I had all these gambling debts. Thankfully, I paid it off, honey. But now I'm in the clear. Now it's you and me again. You don't
because
want to have
that would devalue all of the empowerment. That
the whole point is she won four women. She beat this guy who's being a pig. And even though he's in on the joke, it's still good that he lost because he's a gambling addict and he's not really a good guy. All right. There's no doubt they're stretching the truth. They're taking it what they want or don't want. And I get it. It's not a documentary. You don't have to make it factually based. I was just curious as I was watching it. But yes, listen, Hidden Figures crowd, you'll love it. I'll give it 2 Maple Leafs. It was fine. It passed the time. One more for you. I'll make it quick. It's called Earth, One Amazing Day. It's a beautiful tribute to this wonderful land we live in. If you are an environmentalist, if you love nature, if you just love animals, I mean, this is a great film to watch. I was sent a screener by our friend Ryan Bender, who's great, always hooks me up. Robert Redford narrates it, and it's awesome. I mean, it's just gorgeously shot. It's done by BBC Films, so hopefully you can find it. I don't know if it's going to be playing in theaters necessarily, but hopefully you can find it on your streaming devices or Netflix or VOD or something like that. But it's just beautiful. It's 90 minutes. Remind me a little bit of that great film, Winged Migration, that documentary. It was so beautifully shot, that wonderful music. This time you got Redford narrating. You got... the stories about bears, you get fish, you get penguins, you get them all in their habitats, and it's really well done and a great family film as well. So check out Earth, One Amazing Day. I'm giving that 3 Maple Leafs. That is the bright side of life. Now we turn towards the dark side as Scott Feinberg from The Hollywood Reporter will join us now to talk about this guy, Harvey Weinstein, who is quite a monster. We'll get into your journey and just how life has taken you to this point, but let's start with the... oh, this just grotesque stuff coming out about Harvey Weinstein. Listen, I read Down in Dirty Pictures, Scott. I'm well aware of the fact he's always been a boor and an ogre and berates people and yells, but obviously I had no idea the level of the sexual harassment. I'm sure many people are feeling like George Clooney. Yeah, we know Harvey's a dog. Yeah, we know he hits on young girls, but I had no idea this was happening. I can't think of a more horrifying story than the fact he cornered a woman, you know, starts masturbating, ejaculates into a potted plant. I mean, it's just, it's horrifying. And now the rape, and more women are coming out, Angelina Jolie, Rose McGowan, the rest of it. What has your reaction been to how this story has just exploded?
You know, I think you nailed it in citing the George Clooney reaction, because I think that that really is the way that I have experienced this, in the sense that, you know, everyone knew Harvey was sort of a bully and a jerk and whatever, but he was making great movies. And the thing that what none of us had any reason to, I won't say none, I'm going to speak for myself. I knew him. I interviewed him many times. I saw him a zillion, you know, my whole beat is awards, which was his specialty. So I saw him everywhere, and I never in my life saw any of this in person or really heard anything about it until the Bill Cosby situation came to a head a few years ago. And then we started to meet and say, is there anything like this going on in our backyard? And that's the first time that a few people mentioned, you know, we've heard things about Harvey Weinstein, and Rose McGowan's been making sort of insinuations without naming him, because I think that would have jeopardized her in a few different ways. So, you know, we then started looking into this, I would say 2 or 3 years ago. And I will tell you that we weren't the ones that ended up getting it up first. But what's bothered me is there have been a lot of people that who have suggested that Hollywood knew about this, and it was this open secret, and everybody just covered it up because we loved Harvey so much. And I can tell you that nothing was further from the truth. We had to interact with him. He was a very central figure in the community. But as this all started to kind of come to the surface, and you know, I still never had any idea it was of this magnitude. But over the last couple of years, when we were getting wind of the fact that there were situations like this, we were very aggressively looking into this. And really, not to ask anyone to feel sorry for us, but it was at quite a bit of risk to our own livelihoods, because this guy was extremely powerful when he was in power. And so it's just been a little upsetting, obviously, first and foremost, it's been very upsetting to hear about what he subjected women to. But it's also been, I think I want to take this opportunity to just set the record straight, that this was not something that, you know, either everyone in Hollywood knew about this and just didn't care, or that nobody was working on. There were a lot of investigations, especially in the last couple of years, that were, you know, it's just very hard to publish something when you don't have somebody to go on the record. And finally, that was the breakthrough that the New York Times was able to overcome.
It's a great point you make, Scott, because you're getting some conservative commentators who are now saying, all right, so all you Hollywood liberals took shots at Donald Trump for his comments, and about Bill O'Reilly and Roger Ailes. But now somebody who has given a ton of money towards Democratic causes, who supported President Obama and Hillary Clinton, et cetera.
Right.
Okay, now it's one of your own. So you're right. It becomes frustrating because you go, listen, we weren't protecting him. It's just nobody knew it was to this extent at all.
Right. I wish you could have seen the bulletin boards and charts and magnitude of the investigation that we were doing. And I know it was happening at several other outlets. I'll leave it to them to you know, share that. But it's just a very tough thing, because without somebody on the record, you can be sued out of business. And that doesn't help you, and it doesn't help the situation, because he's still there. And so it was really a situation sort of, you know, I kept thinking about The Wire, you know, if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Yes.
And we didn't want to miss. And it doesn't mean that we weren't working very hard to get to the finish line, but it just, you know, you've got to do it right.
That story about Gwyneth Paltrow was particularly terrifying, because imagine, right, you're a young actress, you know how big Harvey is, you got this role in Emma, he comes on you a little bit, let's go for massages, you say no, you're horrified, you tell Brad Pitt who you're dating, Pitt tells Weinstein, hey, knock it off. Weinstein then calls Paltrow, berates her, yells at her, and she's thinking, I'm going to lose my job. Just imagine, like, the intimidation tactics and the fear. I mean, this is just horrific behavior, right? When you really imagine what must have been going through these young actresses'
minds. Oh, it's terrible. I mean, this is a guy who was unlike anyone else really in Hollywood, in the sense that he at least today, you know, he was much more like the old moguls that used to run the business at a time when this kind of behavior was not bothersome to people. I mean, he the you know the casting couch era. The stories are infinite about the mayors and Cones and people of that era and the things that they subject people to. Some of those women are still alive and are beginning to talk more about it now. But obviously, you know, the times have changed, thank God. And unfortunately, some people didn't get the memo. And, you know, and this is just an unbelievably extreme example. I mean, it's shocking most of all, I think, in the sense that, like with Cosby, you just can't believe that you were out amongst so many people who were affected by this. And yet it's just, I mean, it speaks to the level of power that he possessed and fear that he kind of gave off to people, because, you know, for this many people to stay quiet for this long and then to have it all come flooding out right now, it's just unbelievable.
You mentioned the fact stories keep coming. Just now on my phone, I got an update from The Hollywood Reporter saying Cara Delevingne is now detailing
yep.
her record. So, I mean, everyone's
yep. just...
He's now
going to
be...
And I'll tell you what, it's more coming. There's more coming.
Apparently he's going to go to Europe, sex addiction rehab clinic there. He thinks he can somehow get back in the game. This feels like this is irreparable.
Not in a million years. I mean, this is... Roman Polanski did a horrible thing to one person, and you can't be associated with him anymore. You know, he's just... It's obviously a different situation. Woody Allen, it's not even 100% established whether or not he did what he's accused of, and there are a lot of people that won't be associated with him. You know, this is going to be like Bill Cosby level pariah status, and I think that, you know, he may find that he wants to stay in Europe because at least he won't run into as many people that he knows and, you know, can maybe live some sort of a quiet life. But it's just, you know, in the grand scheme of Hollywood history, there are few people who have had more influence over the business and more, you know, had more of an impact just over the last 30 years. He totally changed the game, and to have him in a period of a week, it's not even been a week since that New York Times, the initial article came out, to have him out of a job, out of the country, out of a marriage, out of polite society, I think, you know, forever. I don't see how he can possibly in any way come back from this. It's just an unbelievable turn of events.
You're right, because it's horrific. We had Garth Davis, the director of Lion, on last year,
yeah.
and I asked him about Harvey, and he goes, you know, he really does love film. Like, he goes, watching
right.
a movie, he said it was like The Bicycle Thief, and he loves De Sica and, you know, Fellini's old movies. The fact he got Gangs of New York made with Marty, the way he championed Tarantino, and all that, you're right, it's extinguished now because of this irreparable behavior. It really is.
Well, nice. And you know, to bring a sports parallel in here, I mean,
Eternal-esque.
It's going to be very interesting how history judges him, because, you know, this is a... obviously in a very different and a much more extreme version of the Pete Rose situation. I mean, you cannot deny that this guy is responsible for an unbelievable contribution to the art of movies, where there's no Tarantino without him. He'd still be in a video store. Judi Dench would have never, you know, really had a film career. Neither would Kate Winslet. Ben and Matt would still be in Boston potentially. I mean, you can go on and on and on. And then five best pictures. He had a tremendous impact and unbelievable achievements as a producer and a distributor. But, you know, he's clearly a repugnant person. And so and we knew that he was a bully, which was not a good thing at all and not really acceptable. But this is at a different level. And so now, you know, if there were an equivalent of the, you know, movie Hall of Fame, I don't know how you adjudicate somebody like this.
No, you're right. Pete Rose is a great example. You'll still get some vigilant defenders, but it's too difficult to exonerate all the other stuff. We're talking with Scott Feinberg
right.
of The Hollywood Reporter. Awards Chatter is his podcast. I just saw Blade Runner 2049, Scott, and I've always said this, but I'm still amazed. Since you cover the awards beat, can you please tell me, hopefully you can get him, how is Roger Deakins never won an Oscar? This guy's the greatest cinematographer ever, and I see he's the heavy favorite to win this year. Please make it happen.
Well, he's incredible, but here's the problem that he keeps running into. And people, you know, I totally agree with you that it's unfathomable that somebody with that much talent and so many great credits, all the Coen Brothers movies, so many others,
right.
You know, that he has not won. And he's got over a dozen nominations. It's just, but here's the bottom line. The voting system of the Academy Awards is what's doing him in, because the way it works is that there are a bunch of different branches of the Academy. So meaning there's the actors, there's the cinematographers, there's the makeup artists and hairstylists and on and on and on. and each branch picks the nominees for their own area. So in the case of cinematographers, the cinematographers in the Academy pick the nominees. That's why he gets nominated so many times, because they know what he's doing is great. But then for some reason that the Academy has never been able to really explain to me, and I think it's ridiculous, the second round of voting, not just for Best Picture, but for all categories, opens up to all the branches. And so what ends up happening is cinematographers that are, you know, fewer than 10% of the whole Academy, which means that 90%+ of the Academy who's voting on that award for Best Cinematography don't really know what they're talking about. And so what they tend to do is gravitate towards the nominee in that category that they like the most overall as a movie. And so, again, this year, he'll probably be nominated for Blade Runner 2049, and as he should be. But he will then probably lose to a movie like The Shape of Water or something else that is going to be a much more overall popular movie with the Academy, because that's, you know, it's just genre movies are less their cup of tea. And, I you know, Shape of Water is another one that's sort of genre. But, I mean, there's no way that you get the full Academy. I would be very surprised if they went for it. Now, the other problem for Roger Deakins is that on the ballot, the only time you actually see the name of individuals as opposed to the movie that they worked on is in the acting categories and, I believe, direction. And so otherwise, what happens when you see Best Cinematography on the final ballot is it just says Blade Runner 2049. Now, that should be enough because it is such a beautiful movie, you would think they'd vote for that. But because you don't see Roger Deakins' name next to it, a lot of people forget it's him, and again, they just go to the movie they like the most, which probably is not going to be this 2-hour, 45-minute, you know, pretty good but not great movie. So that's the problem for Roger.
Yeah, it's unbelievable. I love the way you explain that, because now that make sense to me, how these things keep happening. I get so frustrated.
Right.
Is Christopher Nolan finally going to win an Oscar for Dunkirk?
If the Oscars were today, he would win. But, you know, the problem for him is that his movie came out in the summer, and that's a long, you know, 6-7 months before the eligibility period ends and people get to start voting for nominations and then later wins. I think that, you know, what's incredible is he's never even been nominated for Best Director. He's going to be nominated this year for Best Director, or at the beginning of 2018 when those come out. But I think he has an excellent chance of winning, because I've now seen most of the field of what's going to be coming down the road. There's a few movies that we haven't yet seen, like The Post, which is Spielberg's movie with Hanks and Meryl Streep about the Pentagon Papers, so you can never count something like that out. But right now, I think it's probably between Nolan and the director of The Shape of Water, Guillermo del Toro. Those two just had massive massive undertakings with their movies this year and did an incredible job.
Yeah, the trailer alone for Shape of Water. You know what, Del Toro, obviously the director of Pan's Labyrinth, he's going to be risky and take chances and do something different. What's the movie you've enjoyed most? Maybe you saw it at TIFF or you saw a screener that hasn't come out yet that you're most excited for?
Well, I'll tell you, the good news is it's a movie that opened just this past Friday, and I really encourage you and your listeners to check it out as soon as possible, because it's not an obvious box office, you know, draw, because there's only the only name in the cast who anyone's ever heard of is Willem Dafoe, but it is called The Florida Project, and it is unbelievable. I it's hands down my favorite of 2017 so far, and I've seen a good amount, as I say, of what's still to come, so it's going to take a really great movie to beat it. The way I've described it is it's sort of like an American Slumdog Millionaire, where it's primarily children who are in a bleak situation. In this case, it's not India, but it's the sort of, I guess you could say, like poor motel, you know, areas around Disney World in Florida, and how, you know, they're in this bleak situation, but they're kids. They don't know that they're hard up. They are going about their lives, and it's just they got unbelievable children, child actors, and it's a beautiful story, and I did not expect at all. You know, going in, I was kind of reluctant to even see it, and it's awesome.
Wow, that is a great endorsement. I knew Dafoe was in it. I heard that he's going to get nominated for supporting actor, but I didn't hear much else about it. So I love that endorsement.
Please let me know if I'm off base. I want to hear from you, but I think you're going to like it.
I'm sure you're going to be right on point. We're talking with Scott Feinberg of The Hollywood Reporter, Awards Chatterers' podcast. I love your podcast because it gives
Thank
me
you.
It gives me the prep I need when my guys come here. So I listened to I listened to Miles Teller, your interview with him before Miles came to ESPN. So when we're bantering, I go, hey, how about that car accident? Because you'd ask him about this horrific incident. And my producer, Dan's like, hey, save it for the air. Come on, what are you doing? But you really, how do you go about getting all your research done? Because you get great stuff from Miles. Your Billy Bob Thornton was wonderful because.
Oh, thank you so much for listening. I really appreciate it. Because, you know, these, as you know from your podcast, these things take a lot of work. And so when, you know, and it's not the kind of thing where you're necessarily in real time getting any kind of feedback. So it's very nice to hear that people listen and enjoy it. So, I, you know, in my case, I just feel obviously you've got to have seen their most recent movie and a chunk of their past important work. And then it's a matter of just reading everything I can find from a handful of the same sources every time. It's, you know, New York Times, LA Times, Hollywood Reporter, Variety, Guardian, Times of London, Telegraph, obviously IMDb and Wikipedia, and then some of the longer form GQ, Esquire, anytime they've been profiled. And you just want to know the subject matter so well before you sit down with them. And you, certainly in my case, I script out questions, but you, if you're that conversant already with their story, then you're able to sort of dance around and improvise in the moment because, you know, the biggest thing is if they see that you've taken the time and care to do that prep in advance, then they're going to go deeper because they realize, first of all, they appreciate it. And secondly, they realize they don't have to just cover the surface stuff because you've already addressed that in your question. So you actually get, I think, deeper material. It's all pretty, you know, this is not a revolutionary idea, but it's just, you know, if you put in the time, I think they respond to it.
It's a fabulous answer, but I'm fixing it on one aspect. Wikipedia? Because I got burned on with Jessica Alba. I read something on Wikipedia. She's like, what? I go, what was it, on my Wikipedia? I said, oh, God.
You're right. It's happened. It's happened. I mean, I the funniest one was, it wasn't on the podcast, but it was when I was starting out doing this stuff. You know, I think it was like 2005, the year Amy Adams was breaking through. Nobody knew who she was. She had just done Junebug. And I went on Wikipedia, and it said, you know, I think it said her real name was Amanda Jessica Adams. So I think the first question I said was, so I understand your real name is not Amy Adams. How did you get to this point? And there was this awkward silence. She said, I don't know what you mean. As far as I know, my real name is Amy Adams. So, you know, you've got to be very careful with Wikipedia. But it can also, you know, where there are cited sources, it can be of some value.
That's very funny. We can all relate to those cringe-inducing moments. How great was Kumail Nanjiani? I hope The Big Sick at least gets nominated for screenplay because he was fabulous. How great did you find him?
Oh, he's terrific. He's you know, for a lot of years I'd seen him as the guy in Silicon Valley, and I thought it was very funny. But he only had, you know, his whatever 1/5 of the whole time to shine, and so to then see this guy have a full movie that he brought to life as an opportunity now to tell this very personal story and to star in it. It was just tremendous. And so I was excited to talk to him, and he has this incredible personal story, part of which is dealt with in the movie, but a lot of it isn't. And I think he's got a very bright future.
Favorite interviews. I know it's really tough. I love when you had like Peter Bogdanovich, you know, you had Carl Reiner, like the legends I think are amazing. Billy Bob, no matter what, is always good because he's so funny and he's so forthright. I thought your Leno interview was fabulous because I was always a Letterman guy, but you did a great job with Jay because you had those nuggets. And people have to listen to the whole thing, but this was the best part of it, is when Leno said to you, the reason why the Larry Sanders Show, which I adored, is the greatest show of all time. Leno was trying to give back to his crew. So he said, the year that you're with me, you'll get $1,000 every year. And he said, just like a Larry Sanders episode, he announced it to the crew. Jake, I talked to you. He's like, yeah, I know it says that I started in 2008, but I actually started in 98. I was interning. Jay's like, oh, so you want an extra $1,000? Right. Like, okay, next person. Hey, Jay, I know it started in 2008 because this is why you can't do this.
Exactly.
Things. You can't look
after
the crew.
You see the insanity, yeah.
But Leno's a guy who I think has always been kind of misrepresented. Like, people view him, like, you know, obviously the Conan stuff, and he stabbed him in the back, and that's how people view it. But I think you got to the crux of it, which is people that worked with Leno adore him. They swear by him. And as he said to you, normally when you get pushed out, it's your own people that do it. But that wasn't the case for Jay.
No, I think, well, I appreciate you listening to that one so closely. And I agree with you that I looked at him very differently after that conversation. I think that the thing there is that, I don't know, maybe it sounds like his general approach is to not engage in, you know, in spats as they come up. But the problem then is that the people who go unanswered, that becomes the sort of understood record of what happened. And I, you know, only he and these other people, Letterman and Conan, know for sure what transpired between them. But I think with the Letterman situation, you know, he makes a great point. He said, I was the regular backup host for Johnny Carson for whatever, 5 years before Carson finally stepped down. Now, if Carson preferred Letterman, you know, that's a little hurtful to me or whatever, but the reality, it's not that shocking that they would go to the guy who they've seen do that for 5 years and who's been waiting in line. Then, you know, there's no, where was the stabbing in the back, basically? Yeah, Letterman was the one who idolized Carson even more, but that's not, there's no birthright to assuming that job. And then with Conan, what Letterman's, or what Leno's saying is, I was number one in the ratings. I'm doing great. And they come and just tell me one day, all right, so at this date in whatever, 5 years from now, you're going to be out and we're going to bring Conan in. And there was no discussion about it or whatever. He says, that's what I was told. And, you know, it doesn't make, he didn't make a huge stink about it, but I don't think he was necessarily very much on board. And, but he went along with it and Conan replaces him. And he, you know, then it, but he, at that time, 5 years later, he's still number one. He's still enjoying doing the work. And I think that NBC realized, we're going to lose this guy to another network. He's going to become our competitor who starts beating us. So they offer him this primetime gig. And from his point of view, he says, all right, I'll do it. I don't want to go to war with NBC here. I don't see how it's ever worked for, you know, somebody doing this kind of a show in that early in the evening, but we'll give it a try. And he did. And it didn't go well for him, but it was really not going well for Conan after him. And he's saying, Conan, blame me. But you know what? Every late night show has kind of a weaker lead in. It's just the nature of, you know, people are not in that mindset yet. So, you know, Conan wants to blame me for, you know, the reason why his show wasn't doing well. But it was ultimately NBC who looked at the situation and said, you know, Conan's not working here and we've still got Jay. Let's not, you know, go down on principle. So I don't see myself any evidence of where Jay specifically was stabbing people in the back. It sounds like the guys that he pissed off just happened to be more outspoken about their positions. But, you know, I'm willing to be proven wrong if those other guys would like to come on the podcast.
Well said. Open invitation. Last one for you, because I could keep you for hours, but I adore Scorsese. My producer loves Denzel and Leo DiCaprio. So dealer's choice. You can tell a story either about Marty, Denzel, or Leo. Whatever you want, Scott.
Okay, let's see. Well, I'll tell you a little thing about Leo, and it's not going to help my relationship with him, but whatever. To whatever extent that exists, he was supposed to come on podcast. He had committed to do it for The Revenant. And at a certain point, I think, you know, realized that he was winning this thing if he just stayed at home and went to sleep all day. And so he's one of the very few people who've ever agreed to do this and then screwed me over by not doing it, which I was not happy about because, you know, especially when you go and tell your boss and others that, hey, Leo's coming on, this is great. And this was in the early days of the podcast. It was a huge thing. We hadn't yet had the you know, sort of bigger names that have happened since. And so it was a pretty devastating thing at the time. But again, I hope he'll come back on because he's a terrific actor. And, you know, now though he's got his Oscar, so I don't know if he cares about getting another one. We'll have to see.
They're all playing the game, Scott. When they got something to promote, hey, I got in the bag. Sorry, not interested, unavailable.
Right.
Awards Chatter is the podcast, The Hollywood Reporter, hollywoodreporter.com. You can find Scott Feinberg's great work, or you can subscribe as I do. Thank you so much, man. I really appreciate
it. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
Actors Showcase.
So shout out to Gina, who listens to Cinephile. She said, I want to hear about Robert Redford, so why not? Redford, an iconic figure. Speaking of Harvey Weinstein, there's a book I read called Down and Dirty Pictures. And it focuses on not only Harvey Weinstein, but also Robert Redford. And I'm going to go back and read a little bit. It's by Peter Biskind, who's a really famous writer. And it's called Down and Dirty Pictures, Miramax, Sundance, and the Rise of Independent Film. Now, Weinstein unsurprisingly comes across as this, I mean, not the sexual harassment stuff, but a complete bore and just a bully and arrogant and yelling and shouting and berating people. But somebody who loves films and really appreciates great quality movies, and obviously champion people like Tarantino and so many others with independent films. It also focuses on Redford and the rise of Sundance. Now, Redford doesn't come across that poorly. He comes across a little bit as aloof. You know, he's kind of just built this giant tribute to independent film there in Utah, and now it's become more commercialized, and he's kind of distanced himself. But I think he's done an enormous tribute towards film. So I just want to get that out of the way. When it comes to Robert Redford's best movies, and we're not focusing on the directorial stuff he's done, because Quiz Show is a movie I love, and you should all watch if you haven't seen it, with John Turturro and Ralph Fiennes and Rob Morrow. But beyond his acting, which is notable, he's done a real service to film, I think, with Sundance. I just want to get that out of the way. Number five is Downhill Racer. It's the best movie I've ever seen about skiing. I saw it about 5 years ago. I'd heard about it, and a friend of mine recommended it to me, so I bought it. It's directed by Michael Ritchie, and it still holds up. It's made, like, I think, in 1969. A lot of great POV shots of him skiing, but he plays this arrogant skier, you know, this golden boy American, and it was really an important film, I think, in Redford's career because it showed that, you know, along with being this, you know, wonderfully handsome guy and the blonde hair and the big smile and all the rest of it, that he could have a dark side and could play a bit of a villain. And in Downhill Racer, he plays this guy who's this, you know, skiing genius who's just not a very pleasant person. There's this one scene I can't forget. He's arguing with his girlfriend. And rather than respond, because he's so frustrated with her because she's upset, he just honks the horn. I'll never forget it. He's like, argh! And just honks the horn for like 10 seconds. He's just so enraged. I'll never forget that scene. Downhill Racer for the POVs and Redford honking a horn. Best movie ever about skiing. Number five is Downhill Racer. Number four is The Natural. Of course, very memorable movie. The book is much better. Dan is a bibliophile. I don't know if he's read the Bernard Malamud book, but it's brilliant. And it's much darker, and it's a completely different ending. I'll never forget one of the last lines is, he walked down the stairs choking back his own self-loathing. Like, you don't forget stuff like that. It's so powerfully written. Of course, the movie glosses it up, and he hits a home run, and, you know, we get showers coming from the lights. But that's okay. It's a movie. These things happen. He was wonderful in the movie, and if you're a baseball fan, you can appreciate how sentimental it is. Number three, speaking of people who never got their due, Robert Redford's never won an acting Oscar. Like, this is insane. He's never won an acting Oscar, and he should have won for number three. Of course, he won an Oscar for Ordinary People, directing, when he beat Marty for Raging Bull. But acting, how the hell has he never won an Oscar? He should have won for number three, which is a movie called All Is Lost. He utters maybe 15 words in the entire movie. There's a couple lines of narration at the start, and then that's it. He's a man. It's very Hemingway-esque. He's a man alone at sea, and he's fighting the elements, and I don't know many people that could carry a movie like Robert Redford could. Close-ups of him just, you know, battling loneliness, reading a book, using his lighter, cooking for himself, beans, etc. You know, just a man at sea, alone with his emotions. And then, of course, all hell breaks loose. J.C. Chandor directed it. This is really impressive because he did a movie called Margin Call, which has a ton of dialogue. There's just a torrent of dialogue. And then, you know, he makes this movie where there's a complete absence of dialogue. I'm always impressed when directors can just go completely against task and try something different. That movie had Kevin Spacey and Paul Bettany in it. So All Is Lost is beautifully shot, a wonderful movie. Mark Simon's a fan of it as well. So make sure you check out that. That's number three, Redford at his most pure acting. Number two, All the President's Men. You could call it Spotlight before Spotlight. Crusading investigative journalist. Wonderful chemistry between him and Dustin Hoffman playing Woodward and Bernstein. Jason Robards won an Oscar as their editor. Excellent newspaper film. And number one is Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid. You can't think about Robert Redford without thinking about his relationship with Paul Newman. Close friends both on and off screen. Wonderful chemistry. I feel like this is like embarrassing that I'm not including The Sting. So I wish I could include both. But I like Butch Cassidy more. And I feel like people know The Sting. It won Best Picture. So this is a rather glaring omission that I'm not putting The Sting on there. Gina's going to be upset. But I'm doing it because I only have one of theirs together. So that's why I'm putting Butch Cassidy one. Dan's appalled.
Yeah. Not only has he never won an Oscar, he's only been nominated once right. as an actor, and it was for The Sting,
right.
which you didn't have in the top five, but somehow we have Downhill Racer.
Downhill
in
Racer's best movie okay. ever skiing. Yeah.
Other notables that you left out, some of his recent work that I like, including Spy Game with Brad Pitt.
I knew you'd like it.
How good is that movie, though?
Tony Scott directed it. It's a really entertaining movie. I do
love it. The Last Castle?
Yeah, him and Gandolfini.
Yeah?
Never saw it. I remember I make mixed reviews. I was like, maybe I'll watch it.
He's
you think
in
it's good,
prison.
I'll watch it. Yeah, prison movie. Yeah. Yeah. Gandolfini's in it. I remember for him and Gandolfini, I wanted to see it. But
I watched this movie, didn't like it, but him and a young Meryl Streep in Out of Africa.
I've actually never seen Out of Africa.
You won't like it.
Yeah.
The movie got nominated for Best Picture, which is right. why I saw it. It's not worth it.
Much like Barry Lyndon on my list. It's one of those movies that I feel yeah. like I should watch, but I don't think I'd enjoy it whatsoever.
And then two more, Sneakers.
Indeed. Yeah, Sneakers, very entertaining. Honorable mention. I do think great
okay.
cast.
Sneakers is great.
Very entertaining. I love Ben Kingsley in that movie. He's fabulous as the villain. But Redford, Dan Aykroyd's in it.
Yep.
It's a really good cast.
And then finally,
Phoenix is in it.
Indecent Proposal,
which I knew you were going to bring up. I'll give you $1 million to sleep with your wife. I'd like to watch Indecent Proposal again. Like, is it just a trash movie, or is it actually a good movie? I tend to think it's the former.
Like, good concept, bad movie,
yeah.
One of those?
Yeah.
Woody
Harrelson to be more like, if I ever had the time, I'd like to go. Somebody watch Indecent Proposal for me, tweet a cinephile ESPN. Tell me, is it just a bunch of trash, or is it actually a pretty good movie? Bob Redford's Best, Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, All the President's Men, All is Lost, The Natural, Downhill Racer, shout-outs, of course, to The Sting, Out of Africa, Indecent Proposal, many others, and directorially, seriously, watch Quiz Show. It's a beauty.
A Scorsese story.
So Dan brought to my attention, as did my friend John Chick immediately, that Martin Scorsese wrote a guest column in The Hollywood Reporter. If you haven't seen it or read it, I encourage you to check it out, hollywoodreporter.com. Of course, you can find the great work of our friend Scott Feinberg as well. The headline, Scorsese on Rotten Tomatoes, Box Office Obsession, and Why Mother Was Misjudged. So I'll read you some quotes from it and then go from there. I guess the first headline should be the fact that he liked Mother, and I obviously did not like it. So here's what Marty said about it. Before I actually saw Mother, I was extremely disturbed by all the severe judgments on it. Many people seem to want to define the film, box it, find it wanting, and condemn it. And many seem to take joy in the fact that it received an F grade from CinemaScore. This actually became a news story. Mother had been slapped with the dreaded CinemaScore F rating, a terrible distinction that it shares with pictures directed by Robert Altman, Jane Campion, William Friedkin, and Steven Soderbergh. He's absolutely right, because the problem is you hear CinemaScore and you go F, you go, oh my God, it's awful. But with CinemaScore, as I explained on Cinephile previously, what it ranks is, did the movie match your expectations of what you thought you'd watch after the trailer? Which is an F, because if you watch the trailer, you go, all right, haunting psychological thriller like Black Swan. Wait, I didn't think it'd be this commentary on religion and environmentalism. So people are upset. So he's right that if you hear F, you go, it's a failing grade. I guess I'm not going to watch this movie. Now, he explains the importance of having preview screenings and how it has been important in the past, even to his own films. He says, you know, obviously nobody likes it. When everyone's working together, test screenings can help answer some very basic questions. Was this piece of information clear enough to the audience? Was the timing right with this scene? What is throwing the audience off at that moment and why isn't it landing? Small, extremely specific issues can be clarified. So Marty's not patronizing the audience. He's just saying CinemaScore, he doesn't care for that particular term. Now, as far as positive and negative reviews, he said, I've gotten positive reviews. I've gotten some negative reviews. And even the ones that have been negative are generally given in a thoughtful manner. But over the past 20 years, many things have changed in cinema. Those changes have occurred at every level from the way movies are made to the way they're seen and discussed. Many of these changes have had an upside and a downside. He likes digital technology, but misses the fact you don't see as many 35mm in screens. So now he goes to the box offices and online aggregators like Rotten Tomatoes, which have absolutely nothing to do with real film criticism. They rate a picture in the way you'd rate a horse at the racetrack, a restaurant in a Zagat's Guide, or a household appliance in Consumer Reports. They have everything to do with the movie business and absolutely nothing to do with either the creation or the intelligent viewing of film. The filmmaker is reduced to a content manufacturer and the viewer to an unadventurous consumer. In a vacuum, he's right. If someone just says to you, and by the way, Mother got a positive rating, so Marty's wrong, the critic. I mean, according to Rotten Tomatoes, it got a positive review. 60% or above is positive. Mother got a 68%. He's right that you shouldn't just bandy about Blade Runner 2049 got an 88%, let's go see it. Does that mean the decline of film criticism? Of course. He's talking about real serious people who love film, Pauline Kael, Roger Ebert, Andrew Serres, etc., who would give you like a, you know, a 10-page review, and that's really what you should watch. But where he's wrong is this. Yeah, it's a number. Okay, when I go to my Flixster app, I check the number, fine. But I can then click on the reviews, and all those, there's hundreds of reviews. You then click on it, and it is there in long form, these beautiful reviews given. So it's always, if Rotten Tomatoes was literally just numerical numbers, if it was like, you know, baseball, we just gave a number, okay, they're hitting 300, that's what this is, that's fine. But that's just the precursor. As Matt actually explained to us in Cinephile, if you want more, you can get more. So if Marty wants serious film criticism, he can read Owen Gleiberman of Variety, Ty Burr of the Boston Globe, Ann Hornaday of the Washington Post, among the critics I enjoy who are very smart, very passionate, and been around for a long time. So I completely disagree with this criticism of Rotten Tomatoes. I don't think that's fair. Here's where everybody thinks about Mother. So the actual, which I think is very fascinating. He doesn't actually endorse it. He does not say this is a great film. This is one of the best movies of the year. This is why I loved it. He just instead focuses on things I think he'd appreciate. As my friend John said, well, he's an auteur. Like you would know Marty would like this kind of movie. And as I said in my review, I do appreciate the fact. That's why I give it 1.5. I should have given it no Maple Leafs, but I said 1.5 because it's audacious and it's different. I'll take 10 Mothers versus 10 Pirates of the Caribbean 5. At least Aronofsky was trying something different. Absolutely. But here's what Marty says. Is it a picture that has to be explained? What about the experience of watching Mother? It was so tactile, so beautifully staged and acted the subjective camera and the POV reverse angles always in motion. Like, only Marty's going to be talking about the reverse POV angles. Like, everyone else is like, what? The sound design, which comes to the viewer from around corners and leaves you deeper and deeper into the nightmare. The unfolding of the story, which gradually becomes more upsetting. The horror, the dark comedy, the biblical elements, the cautionary fable, they're all there, but they're elements in the total experience which engulfs the characters and the viewing along with them. Only a true, passionate filmmaker could have made this picture, which I'm still experiencing weeks after I saw it. I myself am still experiencing it as well, but not in quite the pleasant form that Marty's describing. I'm still revolted by the image of a baby eating. So, it's unsurprising that Marty would support it, because a true artist would want to see films that are different, and I appreciate the fact that he's seeing things in there, like sound design. He's a billion times smarter than me, that he's seeing the way it's crafted and it's well done. That doesn't mean it's a good movie. But I appreciate the fact he's saying, listen, let's not just disparage these films and try to reduce them to a number when they don't do well. It's a huge box office bomb. It's not going to get any nominations. And people that didn't like it really hated it. And he also, this is his best point he makes, is that anyone familiar with the history of movies knows all too well there's a very long list of titles. The Wizard of Oz, It's a Wonderful Life, Vertigo, and Point Blank, to name just a few, that were rejected on first release and went on to become classics. Tomato meter readings and cinema score grades will be gone soon enough. I don't agree with them on that. Maybe they'll be muscled out by something even worse. Or maybe they'll fade away and dissolve in the light of a new spirit in film literacy. Meanwhile, passionately crafted pictures like Mother will continue to grow in our minds. So, again, I credit him for looking out for another filmmaker in Aronofsky, who really has been cut up by people who didn't like him. But I think he's way off base in the criticism of Rotten Tomatoes. Achity's now gone. Matt Achity's now doing something else. So, I actually want to try to get him on the pod and get him to respond to Marty's comments. But I looked up, he's working somewhere else now. So I don't know if we can make a connection to Rotten Tomatoes, get them to respond to Marty's comments. Because I can just imagine, if I'm the Rotten Tomatoes editor-in-chief, I'm like, all right, last time I checked, Marty, silence wasn't exactly met with resounding approval. We still gave you like an 85% Rotten Tomato. Hey, the Irishman, you know what, maybe that feels like a 55%. Okay, Marty, see how you like that number then. I kid. But that's Scorsese's view. Once again, check it out, HollywoodReporter.com. Nobody can ever deny how passionate he is about film. I'm Adnan Virk. Thank you so much for listening to Cinephile. We'll see you next time at the movies.
Don't miss out on the next episode of Cinephile. Subscribe to the Adnan Virk Movie Podcast by clicking the Listen tab in the ESPN app.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. So he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.